Alrighty, welcome to another edition of College Coffee Talk with your hosts, Pearl and Andy Lockwood from Lockwood College Prep. Hello, Pearl.
Hello, Andy. Hello, everybody.
Very caffeinated this morning. We are each, again, with our accoutrement. Join us in a synchronized sip of your morning beverage. One, two, three. I'm going to admit something about my cappuccino.
Too much cinnamon?
No. I said I used almond milk, M-A-L-K.
Yes, and I will tell you that I switched out your milk for milk.
Oh, Sammy's calling you. Our daughter doesn't respect the fact that we're on the air. We have so many issues to discuss today. So this is a show that's really more about us just jib-jabbing here. It's about helping you navigate the process of getting into college, of paying for college, test prep. Why even bother going to college, how to get out of all your student loan debt, which we covered last week, and a whole lot more, particularly your questions. So say good morning to us in the chat. Let us know what questions you have. Just pop them in there. And the topics that we have on tap today are, number one, some feedback from the first ever in the United States digital SAT. Number two, Pearl was working on a little bit of an appeal for a client whose information didn't quite fit neatly in the quote-unquote boxes of the digital FAFSA. And we're also going to be covering some latest, I guess, revelations on, you know, what caused this whole mess with the new FAFSA, all the delays and outages and things like that. Mm. I should have prepped this. There's a question that we had lingering from 2 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. Do you remember what it was? It had to do with the Roth IRA, but it was like a special Roth IRA. And we're not financial advisors, right? So normally I would just respond back. So I can't remember who it was, but if you're watching this either live or replay, I apologize. But this is an answer to your question about special Roth IRA fundings and how does that affect your financial aid eligibility. So I'm going to give you this perspective, this answer from us as college finance experts and admissions experts, but not tax experts. So broadly speaking, if you are contributing to a Roth IRA, and then you mentioned some sort of special Roth, special to me because I never heard of it, then that's always done on an after-tax basis. There's no deduction as opposed to a traditional Roth IRA, where you know, let's say you make $150,000, you contribute $20,000 to your Roth, you get to deduct that $20,000, that it brings your income down. So for a Roth IRA, if you make $150,000 and you contribute to any Roth, your income is still $150,000, even if you put away money, because that's on after-tax dollars. So the answer to the question is that won't affect anything for financial aid at all, right?
Yeah.
Just around that, at that discussion, if you're doing a traditional IRA and you're taking the deduction mm-hmm. on your income, yeah. Does that still get added back, or is that one of the new changes that it doesn't get added back for financial aid purposes?
Right,
it's a change,
exactly.
Right?
Yeah. So that's not counting twice.
Well, used to count twice. Right. I'm sorry, it used to prevent you from counting it twice, but now I think it's encouraged. Now I think there is no add back. Mm-hmm. So in other words, under the old rules, if you made 150 and you contributed 20, your taxable income was 130. But for financial aid purposes, right. They would bump it back up to 150.
Right.
I'm pretty sure
right.
that they no longer do that.
That's right.
So that your new income is actually 130. Yeah. So there's a benefit to contributing for financial aid reasons too, to a traditional IRA.
Yeah.
We are really on a roll today. Okay. So who's here? Who's in the chat? Ooh. Say hi. Who's watching?
We have
a lot
of watchers, not too many. Everyone's kind of quiet today. Feel free to pop in your questions that are college related. All right.
Hello to Sergio, to Chris, to three other people watching with us. And yeah, we have a.
Oh, there we go. Yeah.
First time on Facebook?
Yeah.
Ha.
Yeah.
Pearl's looking for a new phone, I think. Sure. Her storage is
limited.
Yeah.
I'll get on
that today. All right. So feedback from the first digital SAT. So we knew going into it that it was new, that there would be some you know, some reactions to it being new. Primarily, it's a shorter test with shorter reading passages. It's kind of a dumbed down SAT. But the feedback that I heard from clients and read about from, you know, various credible internet source sites is that it seemed really hard to people, and especially the math section. So, you know, what usually happens is if a test seems easy or hard, it doesn't necessarily reflect in the scores because they are in effect curved. So they're not actually curved. It's not like a test you take in high school where there's a curve. But what the people who make these exams understand and do is they engage in something that's called score equating. So they know ahead of time the difficulty of the tests and, you know, what a good score would be in terms of how many answers are correct and how many are not. One of the weird things I'm still not completely able to wrap my head around, embarrassingly, is that there's something called adaptive scoring, which other tests have. I think the GRE has it. I think other exams you take has adaptive testing. So there's three sections, like in the math, the math part. And if you do really well in the first section, which is pretty easy, then you get harder questions. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean score is going to be worse. But what it does mean is that if you don't do so well on that first easy section, then the next section is going to be easier, but those questions aren't worth as much. So you won't be able to get as high of a score if you don't do well on that first section. It's pretty interesting.
Sounds like you won't also be able to really judge how you've done. If you feel like you've done well, it just depends on the questions that you advanced to or did not advance to.
Yeah, I think hypothetically, if you felt the first part, the first, you know, section of the questions on the math section was hard, then you probably didn't get a good math score overall because you would have gotten easier questions, which didn't give you as much of an upside to get a score in the 700s or higher. So anyway, we're all feeling our way about this, and our tutor Marissa is on the forefront of all this stuff, and she's got all sorts of secret prep materials, and she's working with kids right now. We have a class going on for the ACT. We've got another one coming up for the SAT. You know, related to this is that colleges are starting to walk back their no test required policy. So test optional is, I wouldn't say it's dying a slow death, but it looks like it's going to be dying a slow death. So we talked about this before.
Revived on the emergency room table. Right.
Well, the elite schools and some that are not so elite are requiring tests. And I think it's more than 20%.
And coming back to requiring it again, where they had maybe had a year or two where they were not.
Yeah.
So that's the trend to pay attention to.
Yeah. So overall, there's a little bit more than 20% of colleges will require tests. And the most recent ones were, I think it was Brown and Yale just said we are now requiring tests. And they joined Georgetown and Georgia Tech and numerous other competitive schools. So don't think that they don't matter anymore. And I think another reason why the SAT changed was because they recognized that, you know, they were losing relevance, I think, or they were fearful of losing relevance. So that's why they made the test shorter and easier for most people, for the attention span challenge. So it's like an hour shorter than it used to be. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. All right, Pearl. So talk a little bit about the appeal that you were sort of teeing up for a client of ours.
Right.
And start with the concept of the base year, because I think that is critical to understanding for people who are applying for financial aid. If you have a, let's say, a 2025 graduate or a 2026 graduate, let's frame it that way.
Okay. So if you have a current junior and therefore their graduating year is 2025, the financial aid application that you will complete next year will be based on, and all of your numbers will be from the 2023 tax return. This is for next year, 2025 graduates. So it's a two-year look back, essentially, or rather assessment of the income portion of this financial aid formula that doesn't quite square up with what current financial reality may be for any family. So how do you get around that? You can't use a more recent tax return or more recent numbers. You are confined by the 2 year ago tax return. So that's for the 2025 graduating year next year. The 2023 tax return is what you need to use. Well, what happens if your 2023 tax return shows any number of things like you're married and now it's 2025 and you're no longer married? Or in 23, you had a wonderfully paying job and in 24, you were laid off. But you know, now it's almost 2025, you're filling out financial aid forms based on 23, a reality that is no more. What do you do? Okay. So obviously, okay, you appeal it. You appeal it. Great. We want to.
A lot of people don't know they can appeal, first of all.
Okay, so first of all, let's start with that premise. The financial aid eventually, so you file forms, there's going to be back and forth between the school and you. The school's going to continue to require additional information to get a full picture of your financial situation to some extent. And then it will issue a financial aid award to your student if that student gets admitted. Okay. Seems like an obvious point. You're not going to get a financial aid package from a school you don't get admitted to.
We get those questions.
We do. Yeah. We do. So now we're at the point in time where you've gotten a financial aid package award that is based on 2023 tax return. And now it's 2025. And that does not bear reality to your current finances. Okay, what do? So you want to appeal that financial aid package based on the fact that your current financial reality bears no resemblance to what this award was based on, namely your 2023 tax return. So now you're essentially like a little bit of a lawyer in that you're advocating your position when you're making an appeal, and you want to make sure you have your best evidence going, because you don't get 20 bites at the apple when you're presenting a case. I used to be a prosecutor, and when I would be presenting a case, you're going to present your best arguments, all of them, and then once the judge hears you and agrees with you, you're done. You be quiet. You don't throw in every other thing from the kitchen sink. Okay.
Sometimes I feel like you're still a prosecutor.
Sometimes I feel like one. Sometimes. Anyway. So in order for you to do your best in terms of best evidence, you want to provide the financial aid office in your appeal, not just with a discussion about, okay, this has changed and that has changed. You want to back it up with proof. So if your 2024 tax return tells more of the current story, then you want to get with your accountant, your CPA, and have them file that 2024 tax return ASAP, so that along with that appeal, you can attach your, and see my here attached, my 2024 tax return proving this. You don't have to just take my word for it. Here are my taxes that I filed with the IRS. That's a much more compelling argument than if you just write a paragraph saying, you know, my situation's different now. Take my word for it.
Right. And I'm on extension.
And I don't really have anything else to prove it. Or here's the other thing. Financial aid offices like to deal with provable, verifiable facts and what's currently happening. They are not interested in, my husband might be retiring next year, and so therefore our income really will drop if we do that. Ifs, might, future, language, no. Present reality. That's what they want to hear about.
Like you were banging the gavel. It's almost like you went from prosecutor to judge in about 2 minutes.
Yeah.
So very, very important information just, you know, and frankly, when you're filling out an appeal form, which many, not all colleges have, some of them will say, attach your proof of loss of income or something like that. And they'll either ask you for, you know, a glimpse of your tax return. If you're self-employed, you might have to provide a P&L showing the drop. But you always have to be prepared to back it up. You can't just deal with the hypotheticals. That's a important point. We hear that a lot. Mm-hmm.
You want to make it easy for the reader, the financial aid office, the committee that they're going to present your appeal to do something about it, to do something for you.
Okay.
With the one other point on this, with the thought that your appeal is going to be evaluated and looked at in a sea of other appeals. So if you don't have something that compelling to say, just understand how that's going to be taken and viewed when it's going to be read before, during, or before or after a compelling, you know, hey, doesn't have a job anymore, doesn't have a parent anymore, doesn't, you know, just so be careful with your appeals.
The context matters, right? We've had clients say, I don't really have much money left over after I send my kids to sleepaway camp.
Right.
And we're like, yeah, you know, that's something that in college they call privilege, right? You can't make that as an argument to a financial aid officer who makes $50,000 a year and never went to sleepaway camp. All right. So I see some questions coming in here and some more people. Great. Hello to Amy. Maria. All right. This is client Maria. So I'll have you answer this question, Pearl. Maria says, regarding financial aid, my understanding, she's also an attorney. Yeah. So watch yourself. My understanding was that you didn't have to disclose your primary residence information, I guess the value later, but all of the college calculators require it. Mm-mm. So are those calculators accurate at all?
So all of the calculators do not require it. All of the CSS profile requiring schools will require it because all the schools take the FAFSA. But a subset of all the schools also require an additional form, the CSS profile. On the CSS profile, you are asked about the value of your home, what is owed on it, what you purchased it at. And it is not treated, it is not penalized to the same extent as a parent asset. However, there is some penalty attributed to the equity you show in your primary residence for CSS profile requiring schools only. FAFSA only schools and on the FAFSA, and even if you're filling out a FAFSA for a school that requires the CSS profile, nowhere should you put anything about the financial information about your primary residence on your FAFSA.
So Ohio State, for example, is a FAFSA only college, but MIT is a they use their own form, or are they a CSS profile school?
They're a CSS profile school, and they may also use their own form. But yeah,
so it really depends on where any of your kids is applying.
And by the way, this also just brings up a general concept also to the appeals discussion before, but also to this, responding, and also to essay prompts, responding in kind. You're going to have a lot of schools out there, and a lot of schools require different things from one another. You don't want to just start like assaulting everybody with everything that everyone's asking you, because that way you'll just cover your bases, and no, don't do it that way.
Well, Maria is a very shrewd, highly trained attorney, so she would not do that.
You just want to respond in kind to the question and the contents of the party that's asking them, no more, no less.
Just the facts.
Right.
Pearl's the Joe Friday of college advising. All right. I see a lot more people coming on here. So if you have questions, pop them in. This is your opportunity for free college coaching. God, I hate saying that. So let's talk a little bit about some of the latest and greatest, you know, investigations about why the FAFSA caused such a kerfuffle. So just a recap. The FAFSA changed. There was a massive seismic overhaul of the free application for federal student aid. That's the financial aid application that every college uses in the country. And after years of planning and a two-year delay, the Department of Education released the new FAFSA in December. I think it was New Year's Eve, and then had a soft launch, and it was on, and it was off, etc. But it's caused all sorts of problems. And the upshot that affects everyone who's applying to college this year and hearing back this year is that in a traditional year, housing deposits, where you committed, did all the bed parties and all the other important things that go along with, you know, deciding where to go to college, was May 1st. Because everything got pushed back, and behind the scenes, colleges are having all sorts of issues with downloading the new data. That is being pushed back by most colleges. So look for more and more colleges to say, you don't need to give us a deposit by May 1st. It might be May 15th, it might be June, it might even go longer. We'll see. we've been told that the downloaded data from the FAFSA is going to happen this month, but yeah. they didn't, you know, no one's saying.
I'm getting the feeling there's been some backpedaling language again, as predicted.
Right. Yeah. Some of the easiest predictions we've made over the last probably year and repeated them. So what caused the delay? So first of all, you're dealing with, you know, huge bureaucratic institutions. You know, one of the articles that I read, I thought made a very interesting point, which was that they changed the formula to update, you know, eligibility and all that, but they didn't have to also redo all of the software that runs
the
programming.
Did. Right.
But it was overdue. It's based on COBOL, which, you know, people who program haven't used in decades. And the most of the systems, is all these different systems, were from like 50 years ago. They hadn't been updated yet. So it was definitely time to do it, but you didn't have to do the formula and the programming at the same time.
Yeah, that was a big undertaking.
Right, yeah, that was a problem. Plus, the Department of Ed kind of took their eye off the ball with this because they had to deal with COVID and, you know, all these complications. They were trying to get schools open again, according to their language, so they couldn't do both.
By the way, and this same site is the site that's attached to all of the loan repayment programs that have also been released in the last couple of years. And now you have 3 years of everyone not paying, and now everyone is the payments have restarted. So this is all happening in the same website, same site.
Yeah, I mean, there's different programs, and, you know, I'm not sure they're technically on the same site, but they overhauled all this stuff at once when they could have rolled it out sort of, you know, in linear fashion as opposed to all at once. They were, you know, bitching and moaning about not having enough funding, of course, you know, from Congress to do this. Congress, to their credit, didn't authorize, you know, a blank check for the Department of Ed to do all this stuff. It just gets me thinking, like, if they just privatize it and they outsource it, you know, to a competent IT company, there wouldn't have been any issues, because the CSS profile, which is private, never has these issues.
And they've changed
and
it
And they ask for probably, you know, five times as much data.
That's true, they do.
Yeah, so I would have just hired, like, someone from the CSS profile, IT department, and had them do the FAFSA.
Now we're getting philosophical.
No, that's not philosophical. I'm just saying, like, in general, for some reason, the department hasn't asked me what I think yet. But if
you
I were
the Department of Education, its employees who get paid no matter whether this works or not?
Nobody over there, not even the interns. Not even the per diem people. Nobody's asked me, which is insulting. But had they asked me, that's what I would have suggested.
Yeah.
So now you all know. Okay. Any other questions before we wrap up? Pearl Chisner is watching. Pearl Chisner Lockwood.
Yes, she is.
Okay. Usmar. What happens if one parent refuses to submit the CSS profile and divorce, and my son doesn't have a relationship with his father? Our court order does require a small amount of child support, but my son hasn't had any contact since 2020. Father's refusing to share tax returns with us. That is very common.
Very common.
And Pearl Chisner Lockwood has a lot to say on that.
I do. Okay. So take a breath.
Yeah. Don't worry.
Don't worry. You can't get blood from a stone. You can't. The school can't. And if this person is unwilling, that's it. Stop there. Don't even try to ask for it, beg for it, whatever. What will end up happening, what you should do for the schools that require the CSS profile and are looking for the non-custodial parents' information, you should complete the non-custodial parent waiver. It's searchable. Look up College Board non-custodial parent waiver form for 2024-25 if you're for this year. And in that form, it is just based on your circumstances, you would be able to explain no contact or how long it's been or infrequent contact. You want to establish that he's unwilling, he has said so, he's not going to participate, whatever the case is that supports lack of participation, lack of contact, you're going to put in this waiver, accompany it with a letter, and it says this in the instructions, from any third party that is aware that there's this level of lack of a level of contact and participation, be it a clergy, a guidance counselor, a teacher, a lawyer, an accountant, anybody. Those two things should get uploaded. And then at that point, even if a school says, well, it's not good enough and we're not waiving this requirement.
So dramatic.
What can you do? Still nothing, because you can't get blood from a stone. So therefore, you let it be. And that school, I promise you, if your student gets admitted to that school, is going to figure out and provide you a financial aid package based on the information it has. So don't sweat it.
It's always a deadbeat dad, and this happens so much. Yeah. It's not funny. We see this, I don't know, half a dozen to a dozen times a year easily.
But don't feel vulnerable to that he has something that you need. You don't.
Yeah. Good point. Maria says, thanks for all the compliments. I think Pearl has me beat. You know, it's not a competition, no. Maria. Okay.
We can Pearl's, both be great lawyers.
Well, Pearl's very competitive. But
not about that kind of stuff. No. Just like my golf game.
Oh, my God. Let's not even go there. But yesterday. Julia McFadden, did I miss updates on the new fat? Yeah, we talked about that earlier, so you can watch that on replay. And hello to Christine Picano, our associate. Our extraordinary
associate. Yes.
Executive assistant.
Extraordinaire.
Candida, are you able to negotiate / leverage an offer you receive from one college to another? You are able to. You know, it helps if the two colleges compete with each other, that they're basically on the same tier, or there's some other sort of baked in competitiveness, like they're in the same conference or something. But if one school is significantly harder to get into than the other one, for example, you're probably not going to have much luck on that. But that is definitely one of my favorite ways to negotiate offers. All right, Janine. I heard kids who took the digital SAT this past Saturday couldn't submit their test. How awful. Yeah, mm-hmm. I can't verify that. I think there were some kids who couldn't figure out how to submit it. I have a hunch that the data is in there and they were submitted ultimately, but that's just awful. More stress that you don't need. You know, back when we were in the pandemic and what would happen, I think, was even worse, where kids would drive 2 hours, yeah. You know, from like New York City to somewhere in Jersey, show up at the test center, and then find out the test center was closed, and they never told anyone. So, I don't know what's worse, actually. Maybe taking it and not being able to submit it is worse.
Awful. Yeah. All awful. It's just not great. Yeah. Right.
Bruce, can you get aid if you are laid off, but you own a home and have a large retirement account? The short answer is income is the most important thing.
Right.
Retirement accounts do not factor at all.
But if you have required retirement income, distribution income that's hitting your tax return, potentially putting you in a place where you may not be need eligible, that's where it could impact. But just having the assets in retirement is not going to hurt you.
Yeah, you have a very good argument that you will qualify for aid, because if you had a huge drop in income, and let's say you have no other severance income or something like that, depending on how you look in the formulas, you have probably a formulaic argument and a non-formulaic argument, which is that, look, even if I wanted to take equity out of my house, no bank's going to approve me without income. There's usually a handful of others, you know, like a cluster of adjacent arguments that go along with, I currently don't have income. So that might be one of them, and that might be the silver lining in a tough time, I'm sure. All right, I think I saw one last comment coming in, then we're going to wrap up here. Okay, this one's for Pearl. From Maria Tina Petty. If you have a rental property and it's in a company, in an LLC, do you have to disclose that?
Yes, you do.
All right, thank you. Have a good week. Well, all right, what do you mean?
Okay, so I'll try to be brief. If it's in an LLC, on the facts, so yes, of course, to all these answers on the CSS profile, but specifically, I'm guessing that you're asking me about the FAFSA.
Well, cover both, Pearl.
Right. On the FAFSA now, the value of your business, value netted against the debts of your business, is reported now as a separate line item in the asset section of the FAFSA, okay? So you're going to give three numbers in terms of your assets on the FAFSA. The first is a total of the parent cash checking and savings, that's one. The second is a total of the parent's non-retirement investments. And then the third is the net value of the parent's business. So that's brand new. And while it is a number that gets figured in, whatever, in your, so in your case, the LLC that has the asset, this property, whatever the net value of that property is, and maybe you're upside down, in which case you'd enter a zero, but if you have some value there, whatever that value is, and that's the only asset of that business, then that net value would be put on that third line net business value. What I can share with you, though, thankfully, is there is a different seeming lower penalty that is attributed to that business value on the FAFSA. It is not treated the same as the two top figures, not the, like a regular personal parent asset. It's yeah, treated differently than the parent's personal asset, is right. But it is now given some penalty, but not as much. So to answer your question, if this investment property is in an LLC, that's how it's treated. If it was not in an LLC, just to round out this discussion, you had an investment property that you owned personally.
Do you hear the Oscar music playing?
Then the value, the net value of that piece of property would get added to the parent's non-retirement investments. And it would be treated with that same 5.64% penalty.
I was trying to play Oscar music. Yeah, when the acceptance speeches go on too long.
Oh yeah. Oh my God, that was the cane. So sorry.
No, that was very good. Very good explanation. All right, so we are done for this week. Join us. Any questions that came in after last call and under the gun, we will answer them in the comments section. Mm-hmm. Please join us next week, 10 o'clock Eastern Mondays, 10 to 10:30. For College Coffee Talk, thank you very much for joining us. Nice, fulsome answer today. Congratulations. Thanks. On your Oscar nomination. Okay. and award for best college advising show on
Facebook.
On Facebook, yeah. All right, take care, guys.
Bye.